You're listening to the Clean Comedy Podcast with James Creviston and Luke LaCoy.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Clean Comedy Podcast. It's James, and today I'm here with my co-host, Mr. Luke LaCoy.
Ahoy, hoy.
Ahoy, hoy. And today we have a great, phenomenal, amazing guy here. I mean, legend in comedy. If you read The Onion, if you know anything about writing comedy or you want to learn how to write comedy, this is the guy. We got him. I don't know how we got him. I think I tricked him into getting onto the podcast. I think he doesn't know what he's getting into. No, he is. He does. But I've been trying to get him for about a year, I think, or so. And so finally we have him. So please welcome the very funny, the very talented, the amazing co-founder of The Onion, Mr. Scott Dickers.
Excited to be here. So sorry we're off to a late start. My fault entirely.
No worries. No worries. We're here for you. I appreciate you taking time. So sure. You are a legend among comedy writers. You are.
All right.
Like, literally, one of the first books anyone told me to read when I started writing comedy and doing stand-up or anything was How to Write Funny, and that was your book. And now you have – there's four of them, 1, 2, 3, and then How to Write Funny Characters. And how did you get that much knowledge of comedy? Because I know you started The Onion, but I know you also did comic strips, and you just wrote a new book that's like a fiction kids book. I haven't got to read that yet, but, like, where did that come from? Because that's not – innate in everybody, but you seem to be like this genius at comedy. How's that work?
It's very kind of you to say. So, you know, I think because I've been doing it my whole life, like I've been obsessed with doing it since day one. And you know how it is when you do something for 20 years or whatever, Malcolm Gladwell says 10 years, if you do it obsessively, you're an expert. And so by the time I was 18, I felt like an expert already. And I had done writing, I had done performing, I had done drawing, you know, I had done pranks, you know, street art. I had done every kind of comedy you can possibly, and I did it obsessively. It's all I ever did. I flunked out of high school because I was focused too much on making comedy short films. So, so I started doing voice work and I did that for a few years. And then I started doing a comic strip. I did that.
Yeah.
And so I was already a successful comedy professional when The Onion came around, and I jumped in with those guys. And after a year, I was just a cartoonist for them in the first year, and then they sold it to me. So it became wow. kind of my thing, and, you know, took it over and built it into what it is, and always felt like the expert. Like the writers who would come and work at The Onion, I always wanted people with no comedy experience. I wanted just pure newbies. Because then I could train them in my method and they wouldn't come with any hacky habits or whatever. And so I always took on this role of like the teacher, father, editor guy who everybody looked up to, like, oh, he'll tell you how to do it or whatever. He knows how it works. And then I just got sucked into The Onion for a good 20 years. And as part of The Onion, we did so many things. We did radio comedy. We did a couple of at least 5, 6 TV pilots. You know, we sold movie ideas and movie scripts, and I optioned other movie scripts on my own, and I sold a couple of independent films. And so I always had my hand in every medium. And then when I left The Onion in about 2014 and started doing this thing at the Second City in Chicago where I taught comedy, it was so natural for me to just pass on what I knew. And the book was just me passing on everything I knew about comedy, the first book. And I knew it all started with the joke. The joke is like the atom of comedy. So how do you write a joke? Well, I know how to do that. I've been doing that my whole life. And at this point, I'm like 50 years old. So it was a really interesting experience. I'd never written a nonfiction book. I'd never written a straight like how-to book or anything like that. And didn't know how it would go off or whatever. And people loved it and they bought a lot of it and it worked for them. And it became the basis of the curriculum for this series of classes at the Second City, which I'm now teaching on my own outside of Second City. And yeah, I just sort of, it's funny, you know, how life works. Like I was talking to Weird Al about this. He was the first guy I ever interviewed for my podcast.
Wow.
And I was like, you're like the elder statesman of parody songs. Like, how does that happen? Because when I was growing up, you were the goofy song parody guy. And then all of a sudden, you're like the expert. Everybody looks up to you. And we were just sort of laughing about that because that's how it works. Like, enough time passes and you're an expert. You're an elder statesman. And you didn't even try to be. You're just doing the work, you know? So anyway, that's my long, boring answer to your very simple question.
That was not boring. And you know what's funny is I was just listening to Weird Al, The Essentials right before we got on this, because that's what I usually listen to that when I'm writing comedy stuff, because it just, I don't know, it just kind of keeps me in that mood.
That's great. Yeah, I love his, like, he's such a great, free-flowing source. It just puts you in a mood. I totally agree. Yeah, that's a great.
Well, he's an amazing wordsmith, because he's taking songs that you know all the words to, right? And then he has to make them very different and funny. That's a genius. I've tried to write parody songs. I am not good at it at all.
It's a very specific skill. Yeah, I don't do it either.
What was your first exposure to comedy? You said you started young. Was there something that like set you off, that like kind of grabbed you and said, oh, this is what I love?
I can't remember if it was just I liked it, or like I doing it, or if I liked being an audience of it. But, you know, I remember early TV shows that I watched, like Sesame Street had a big impact on me. I didn't like Mr. Rogers because it wasn't funny. It was boring. But I liked Sesame Street because it was fast cutting and they had little skits and they had a sense of comedy. They had a sense of, you know, this skit has a punchline. And it was like, oh, okay, I see how that worked. And I was fascinated by the educational aspect of it. So I learned how to read early and learned how to write before kindergarten. And so I started making my own like ABC books, and I would make them funny. Like I would make little jokes for each letter. And I would give those to my grandma and show them to my mom. And they were just tickled pink. Like they were just like, oh my God, these are the funniest things. And so, you know, I'm getting that beautiful first laugh thing that every comedian talks about. I'm getting it when I'm 4 years old. And I'm like, okay, I'm addicted to this.
Yeah.
How can I recreate this for the rest of my life? So did more books, started drawing, you know, learned how to draw cartoons, and then became a class clown in school. And so, you know, so as I'm growing up, there are things like Steve Martin was really big. Oh. And he was such a great comedian to be exposed to as a young person, because yes, his comedy is funny and it's very broad and he does all the basic things you're supposed to do, set up punchline, et cetera, but it's so meta also. And so it's so intelligent, and you look at that and you study that and you realize there's so much more to it. And then, you know, he sort of led me to David Letterman and Andy Kaufman. And then you're getting into some real meta stuff. And that's what really fascinated me, because it was so advanced. And like, even at that age, I knew that it was advanced, and sort of doing like a basic gag was just that, basic. What's more interesting? Well, doing something meta, like tricking the audience or making the audience angry, and then making a whole different part of the audience find that even funnier, you know? So it's like, how do you maximize the laughs? And then it just became like, you know, doing a puzzle. It just became like, how can you create the maximum possible laughs while angering the least amount of people? You know, that's sort of the equation that I was always striving for, you know?
Right. Luke, did you have a question?
Yeah. I appreciate your work you did at a Comedy Wire. I remember a couple of like I was in some of the talks that you gave, and awesome. Specifically like the funny filter talks you gave. So that, yeah, super helpful.
Great.
So thanks for that. Yeah. And I'm curious about Jim's journal. So was that kind of like the idea to poke fun of, like, well, I mean, I guess like be a satire to other comics?
Yeah, absolutely. So that was one of those meta humor things that I looked at the comics page that were on the Sunday page whenever it would come to my house. And I literally hated all the comics. I just thought none of them were funny. They were so hacky and they were so predictable. But I was drawing my whole life and I wanted to do comic strips. I did a comic strip in my high school paper that was a little more straight, you know, as a comic. And then I did a few other comics and sold them around. And then Jim's Journal was like, yeah, what's a parody of comic strips that would nonetheless, so it would also, it would make fun of all comic strips. It would be really unique, really original, really different, but it would also satisfy all of the requirements of a comic strip even better than real comic strips. So it would give you characters that you loved and wanted to see every day. It would give you laughs. It would give you a sense of familiarity every day when you see the strip. It's like coming home. It's like something very personal about comic strips. It's like your little world. You're going to enter this little world for this little short period of time in the day or whatever. And so that was a really fun early experiment. And I was coming up with so many different comic strip ideas. That just happened to be one that hit. Mm. So ran it in the college newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, and it really took off. And, you know, I made a ton of money like selling t-shirts and selling books. And, you know, then it's just, it's got a life of its own. But that was the point of it. And it worked. And it did piss off a lot of people. People were like, this isn't funny. I don't get it. There's no jokes. And then other people are saying, this is the funniest comic strip I've ever seen. So I'll take it. You know, I don't care if I'm pissing off X percentage of the audience. They're not my audience. You know, mm-hmm. the people who love it are my audience. Same as Andy Kaufman. There are people who were angry at him for eating ice cream on stage and not doing an act. Like, yeah, where's the jokes? You know, so I'm going to do what I want. And these people are laughing. So get out.
Yeah. Perfect. I have a question about the Onion. It's kind of funny because you with the Onion or like even the, like the Babylon Bee, the satirical news has somehow become real, almost real news. Like it's to a point where news is almost satire. Like you predicted some things satirically that then happened. How do you feel about that? Where like news is almost a joke unto itself.
Yeah, it's very surreal. And I think part of the reason why that is, I think the world is not any more crazy. I think the world is just as crazy and people are just as stupid and crazy as they always have been. So there's plenty of fodder for jokes if you're making jokes using a news format. What I think makes it more crazy now is that the news media itself has changed so much since The Onion came around. So Onion debuted in 1988. Wow. And USA Today was kind of the biggest, baddest bugaboo of journalism at that time. And all it was a kind of infotainmentization of the news. It was big, colorful pictures, short articles. And it's so funny, they haven't changed much, but now they're literally winning Pulitzers and they're like one of the few remaining legitimate news sources in the world.
Right.
So what happened with TV news and all that is that during the 80s, it got deregulated and networks were no longer supporting news as a public service. Now news had to be supported with advertising dollars. So the news became infotainment and it was like, how can we keep people watching? How can we make it more exciting? So it's just a show, it's just a big clown show and it has nothing to do with like informing the citizenry or like the electorate. It has absolutely zero to do with that. And that has all changed in the time that the Onion has been around, the 30 years or so. So I think that's why they are literally discovering that the zanier stories, the crazier headlines are the things that get the most clicks. So instead of telling us, you know, the Senate voted down Senate resolution 4-2-B today, which is something we all need to know and should know, who cares? Like nobody's clicking on that. Give them, you know, give them Catch Me Outside Girl, you know? So that's where we live. That's the world, you know?
I guess I never thought about it that way. I just thought like, oh, they see, oh, the Onion's doing this and it's good. We're just going to make all of our titles clickbaity and then boom, people will come to us instead. But then they became
some of that thing of,
yeah, but then it became this thing of like what you say on the Onion could actually be a real news headline the next year. And you're like, what is happening in the world?
Yeah, well, that started happening pretty early where we would do a headline and then a year or two later it would come true. And to me, that's like the holy grail of comedy because comedy that you make up and write that gets a laugh is a totally different universe than comedy that happens in real life that people notice and find funny. The audience has two different mindsets for each thing and they need to know the difference or they get very confused.
Yeah.
And so when you're hyperbolizing and you're coming up with some zany situation in The Onion, that you hope will be funny, and then it actually comes true in real life, and it's funny in real life, like that really is, you feel like you've really nailed it.
Does it scare you though? Are you like, oh, I that was a weird prediction that we should have, like, it was crazy that we made that up and then it really happened. Does that scare
sometimes,
you?
Yeah, sometimes. Like, you know, a lot of the Trump predictions.
Yeah.
And some of those were in The Onion. Some of them were in this book, Trump's America, that I did in 2015. But a lot of that came true. And we were just trying to be as outrageous as we possibly could. And real life ended up being even more outrageous, you know.
You have to wonder if he like looked at the book and was like, that's a great idea. I should do that.
He did send one to the Obama White House, and there was one on the shelves, according to the source that we had there. And I'm sure it got removed before Trump got there. And I'm sure he never saw it. But, you know, we always hope, the hope is always, you know, get him angry, get him suing, because that's how you get all the publicity. That's how you get all the attention. And they always lose. They always try and fail. And their lawyers are like, you can't sue. It's freedom of press. What are you talking about?
Right.
But they gin up so much attention. It's just wonderful.
Does it concern you with the, like, people call it cancel culture. Does it concern you with that kind of stuff where if you did write something that there may be a day where they could sue you, where they would win because of the, like, the cancel culture type thing that they're trying to push?
No, I don't really equate cancel culture with, like, slander or libel. I think that's right. Totally different. Cancel culture is one of those things that it's so funny because the only people worried about cancel culture, it's very interesting, note this, is guys. Am I going to get canceled? And obviously if you're raping women, you should be canceled. But to me, no, it really doesn't have any bearing because I haven't raped anybody. And so yeah, to me, separate thing when it comes to like mocking a public figure or something like that. But The Onion has done so much in the past that you could look back on and, you know, theoretically drudge up and cancel me or any writers or whatever. But over the years, you've developed this reputation of being equal opportunity or whatever. And everybody knows what The Onion is now. It's kind of harmless. It'd be like going through SNL and saying, you know, you weren't sufficiently anti-transphobic in 1982, so you
yeah.
You guys are gonna pay. I just don't see that happening.
Yeah, I mean like they do dig up people's tweets and they do dig up people's stuff. That's why I'm like, man, that's crazy. Like you could write a joke, it's clearly a joke, and then somebody takes it as like, yeah, this person is this thing, and you're like, that was a joke, like that's not, so it's crazy.
Yeah, no, it's you know, there have been obviously close calls with The Onion. And I think that situation you're talking about, that's the worst of cancel culture, when somebody's trying to get a job and they scour their Facebook and they find a post from 8 years ago and they're like, oops, sorry, can't hire you.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I'm not out applying for jobs, so I don't care if anybody does that.
With our phones being an extension of us, are we spending too much time on them? Is it becoming an addiction that's holding us back from our full potential? At overcomephoneaddiction.net, you can read all about the ways phone addiction affects you and how you can overcome it. And as someone who is always on the phone, this has helped me start a one-day detox, limit my screen time, and reconnect with time away from the screen. Check out overcomephoneaddiction.net and pick up their new ebook, audiobook, or video today. Luke?
Yeah, James is safe. He deleted all his social media. So
I did. Okay, here's why. Because I wrote a joke that I thought was funny. Wait, okay. So Anthony Jeselnik that came on, was on a podcast, and they said, when is too soon for something? Like, you know, a 9/11 joke or whatever. And he's like, never. He's like, I want to be the first one. And I was like, ooh, I'm going to try that. So then the Ariana Grande thing happened where like the bombing of the thing. And I wrote a joke about it on Twitter. And I literally had just gotten a writing job for a comic book company. And I lost that job because of the tweet. Cause I was like, I'm going to do that. I'm going to just link this. And it totally back. And I was like, you know what? I'm done. I'm out. I'm not even going to do this anymore. So yes. So I learned my lesson very quickly.
And you turned to clean comedy for good.
Yeah, because I was trying to play both sides of the fence there. Like, I did stand up clean, but I would write jokes that were a little, you know, more edgy or whatever. Go ahead, Luke.
Yeah, you kind of touched on some of your influences earlier. Do you have any comedy writers who influenced you a lot or that you really enjoy?
Yeah, throughout the years, there have been some, and I didn't know their names, I think, while I was coming up. So except like Chris Elliott, he was an influence, and I knew his name, but like Adam Resnick and Rob Smigel were a couple that had a really big influence on me. You know, a lot of the Simpsons people, surely. Mm-hmm. But the Simpsons, you know, same age as The Onion. So before that, you know, I think Woody Allen had a big impact on me. I bought his books and I read his books. And his sense of story and like being able to weave jokes in a story structure was really amazing. And then another guy who was really big for me was Bob Einstein. So he wrote for the Smothers Brothers and he put out a book in the 60s or 70s. My first book of magic tricks or something like that. He was very Kaufman-ish, but a little bit more audience friendly. And then he started doing the Super Dave Osborne, which he did for a lot of years. And then now he just died. But before that, he was on Curb Your Enthusiasm. And so him and his brother, Albert Brooks, had a big influence on me. They probably did a lot of writing behind the scenes and then early, and then they were on camera later in their careers. But yeah, I people like that, I would say.
I loved Super Dave growing up. It's funny because I just watched the Super Dave movie like the other day. It just happened to go on Amazon Prime. And that was like my childhood. I love that kind of stuff where it's just like very like kind of off the wall, kind of weird. You're not used to it, which is why I love Steve Martin as well. One of my favorites. Yeah. But I'm also a big fan of like Bob Newhart, where there's like this whole engagement of a storyline going on. And I feel like I took some of your courses. I took the Comedy Genius Workshop and the Making Money Being Funny Workshop. So I have those. Great. And I'll take some more because you're literally, there's so much in there that I have to go back and keep listening and learning and stuff.
I appreciate you saying that.
No, I appreciate you because you really have changed the trajectory of my comedy career, because at first I was just wanting to be a stand-up comedian. And then I had a stand-up comedian friend of mine, Dwayne Perkins, come and say, "What else do you do?" And I was like, "Oh, I do a podcast." And he goes, "What else do you do?" And I go, "That's it." And he goes, "You need to do more." And then he said something about your book to me. So I picked it up and I was like, "Oh, I can write blogs. I can learn to write screenplays. I can learn to write jokes for other people." And then I ended up getting my first joke writing gig for a headlining comedian that was about 6 months to a year of that. And then I write screenplays and I write commercials for funny commercials and stuff like that. And all because I didn't realize that funny translates to other things. And you are really kind of the key to that for a lot of people. And I know that I haven't found it anywhere, like another copy of it. And the only copy I can find is like $900 online, but it's like, I think it's like a World War E or Invasion. What's it called? It's your screenplay that you wrote into a book.
Oh, E-Day. That should be on Amazon. It should be pretty cheap.
It's not a Kindle. There's only the physical copies. And they're like, I'm not kidding you, like $900.
I'll look into that because that ain't right. I self-published that book, so it should be available. That's so funny. Yeah, that was a screenplay I optioned many, many years ago, and it totally got scuttled because 9/11 happened and they didn't want any kind of a war satire movie where America got attacked. And that's what it was about. America got taken over by Eskimos was the story.
You know what? I did find it. It is Kindle now, but I found another version where someone's charging $900 for it too. Ooh, that's okay.
Who is that?
I don't know, but they're making a lot of money off your book.
That's very funny.
So that's an actual screenplay. So it's the actual screenplay format. So would you ever recommend somebody like self-publishing their screenplays, or only did it because it got scuttled?
That's why I did it. Okay. Yeah. So if I had a screenplay that was being shopped around, I wouldn't publish it. I might publish a novelization, you know, so I'm writing a novel right now that I think would make a great movie. So I'm just writing the screenplay in consort with the book. So I'll send it off. And I'm possibly changing agencies, and maybe a new agent looks at that and says, "Oh yeah, this could be a movie. Send that to the movie people." That would be great.
That's awesome. And that was what I was going to say is, when you're doing that, writing a comedy novel is hard. Well, a friend of ours wrote like a comedy mystery novel, which was really good. But I've sat down and I can write a like fictional novel, but every time I try to add humor to something that I find like you, there wouldn't be a good, like, or I can't do it myself, like a comedy Tom Clancy novel. Like, you want to do intrigue and mystery, but it would, I feel like it's easier to write that as a screenplay because you could put more moments of funny or jokes in there that you could play with the actors with. What would be your advice for somebody that wants to write like a comedic novel?
Well, there's different ways to do it. You can do the sort of Douglas Adams version where it's very lighthearted and the whole thing is just very jokey. Or like Mike Nelson, who used to host Mystery Science Theater 3000, he writes a lot of books. They're mostly, they're not narrative like stories, but they're very jokey and there's not a lot of deep emotional investment. You know, and those do well, like people like that. I prefer, if I'm gonna do a longer story, I want some emotional investment because I want a story to actually engage people. And so to make that funny, it's a little different. You can't just drop jokes on top of that like you can the other kind of novel. Then it feels like you're breaking character or you're ruining the vibe or whatever. So in that case, you have to have an inherently funny plot. You have to have some irony in the journey, like the wrong person is on this journey so that the people they meet can aggravate that situation and it gets frustrating and silly. And so the situations are funny. And then the third and even deeper way to do it is to do it like Jonathan Swift did it, which was make it really satirical. So you're making some analogy or even somebody like Orwell with Animal Farm or 1984, not funny. Animal Farm is funny.
Right.
So we'll stick with that example. Where there's a really deep and interesting analogy going on and there's interesting satirical commentary going on, then it becomes, I think, a deeper level of funny because you don't even really realize what you're laughing at. You're laughing at the deeper message, you're laughing at the ironic journey, and occasionally you can have gags in there. They just have to spring from those two things. They can't be artificially plopped on top.
Gotcha. Okay. So yeah, that's going to be the hard part. So, cause I can write like a sitcom, a situational comedy, but that's based more on the situation there. And it's kind of easier in that, you know, 30 minute space. Whereas a novelization is going to be a little more difficult, but I think I'm gonna have to go back and work. I think if I read How to Write Funny Characters and work through the How to Write Funnies, I bet I can figure out how to do that. And I'll.
Yeah. I think there's a lot in there about longer form, especially the second book.
Yeah.
Has a lot about longer form or a whole section on like doing dramatic storytelling that's funny, but it takes practice. Like, you know, you got to try it out and see what style works for you. I'm always open to like whatever style feels right. There's no right or wrong. You know, there obviously are certain rules in terms of dramatic storytelling that everybody kind of has to adhere to, but I'm excited to see what you come up with. And it's, you know, for your first book, if you haven't written a book yet, you're saying?
No. Yeah, I wrote a how-to book, but I haven't written like any fictional books.
Got it. It might be a good idea to do, here I am throwing out advice.
No, I please.
It might be a good idea to do a book about your life or your comedy, like with your face on the cover, so that when you do a performance, you've got that book for sale and people liked you, they liked the performance. Why not buy the book version, you know? Like all the big comics were doing that when they would break out in the 80s and 90s. They'd all do a book with their face on it. Because it just helps build the brand, you know? And then once you do that, you've got a book under your belt. Then when you start doing a novel, it's just less daunting. The whole thing about doing a book, especially a novel, is it just feels like Mount Everest. It feels so impossible. I can't do this. Like, it's no way. You get, if you like force yourself through and nose to the grindstone, you're going to get to like chapter 8 or 9 and it's going to totally fall apart. Like every screenplay falls apart at page 50. Yeah. Like, I don't know what's going to happen anymore. I've lost interest, you know? So getting a book or two out of your system first really helps.
Yeah. I thought about that because I have a special that I'm working on for stand-up and I was going to tie in a book to that. That's like, great. You know, like Jim Gaffigan's Dad is Fat. I had like an idea for that and then tie them together. So that might be the way to go. Thank you. No, I'm glad that you gave me that advice. That's sure. This is the best interview ever. Like, I got great advice. Luke, did you have a question?
Yeah. Throughout your career, if you were to go back and maybe like do one thing different, is there anything that you would do different or feel that would help?
Yeah. I mean, just stupid regrets here and there, little things. One of the big ones, it seems so small now, but when my comic strip was making it big, I signed a deal, a merchandising deal with a local t-shirt shop in Madison, Wisconsin. And it was an evil contract. And I was so stupid and young, I didn't even read it. I just signed it. And it was a 10-year deal that automatically renewed for another 10 years. Ooh. So I was locked in for 20 years. And what happened is my first book of that comic strip that I self-published made the New York Times bestseller list. And it was like a big deal. And I got calls from agents and publishers wanting to publish it. And the biggest, best publisher of comic book collections, which is Universal Press Syndicate, they do all the Calvin and Hobbes, The Far Side, everything. And I modeled my books after their books. They called me and said, we want to do your books, we want to do your merchandise, we want to do everything. And I couldn't get out of that contract with this local t-shirt shop in Madison, Wisconsin, just crippling. So that was a big regret. And then, so the lesson there is read the contract, renegotiate the contract. I didn't even know you could renegotiate a contract. I figured you either had to sign it or not sign it. Like, I literally had no idea. When you grow up Gentile like myself, they don't train you about those things. Yeah. You know, they train you that life is suffering. So just toil in the fields and go to church on Sunday and life will work out for you. So I was behind on a lot of the business stuff. And then the other big regret, I would say it's a more current regret, and that is, so I left The Onion many times, but I left for the final time in 2014. And over like 10 years, I sold all my interest in it. And the main reason I sold it all was because I didn't have a lot of faith in my business partners. And I didn't want to leave and own it and have it be this thing hanging over me. They might, you know, be unscrupulous and like make me pay a bunch of taxes, but then not pay me money to cover those taxes. All sorts of weird, tricky things could have happened. And, you know, I should have had faith in the product itself and not the business people running it. Because even though it's changed hands a lot and it's had a lot of weird owners and now it's owned by some investment firm or something, yeah. I should have just had faith that I built a good brand, has a lot of goodwill, and I should just hold on to at least a piece of it. So it's fine. Because it's great to make money without doing anything. Like, it's great to be a business owner and just have an asset that pays you money. And I want more of those. Like, I like that. That's a great way to make money.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about starting something else like The Onion? Not like a news site, but like something else that's kind of satirical or in that same vein of like a comedy site?
Yeah, I've toyed with that. And now I'm focusing mostly on the books.
Yeah.
But I did start a site because I started coming up with ideas and having my students come up with ideas I thought were really funny. So I did start a site. It's called blaffo.com, and it's like The Onion. And then as soon as I did it, I realized, why am I doing the same exact thing that The Onion is doing? There's a billion other publications doing that. The only way to really break through, and it's the reason The Onion broke through early, was because it was doing something different.
Right.
So if I get a brilliant idea to do something different, I'll do something different. But I'm also old and I'm tired, so I just want to be by myself and write my books and teach my little courses. And doing something like The Onion is like a huge commitment, you know, it like really takes over your life.
I'm actually mostly excited for your upcoming stand-up class and your comedy writing screenplay, like comedy screenplay class.
Oh,
those are two that I'm like waiting for to come. So cool. I think I'm on the wait list because
I'm a super nerd.
Comes to your stuff.
I appreciate that very much.
No, I appreciate it. Is there anything else that you want to promote or anything that you want to share or anything that you want to, if you could go back and tell your younger self something about comedy or comedy advice that you would do?
Boy, the thing I keep thinking nowadays, and a lot of, you know, young comedians starting out will come to me and want advice on how to do this and how to do that and stuff. And there's really only one main bit of advice that any young person needs, and that is just do it a lot, you know? And a lot of people aren't doing it. So they're like, they'll say things like, well, there's a pandemic, so I can't get on stage. And I'm like, why aren't you on YouTube? Why aren't you on Zoom? You know, go where you can. And they haven't written books. They haven't published books, even though it's totally accessible to them to do that. They haven't started a webcomic, even though anybody can do that right now. And do the work. Like, that's the main thing. Like, actually sit down and do the work. You might be really funny, but you're never going to get anywhere if you're just sitting around complaining that you have no access to an audience. You have to build that. So that may be very broad and very basic, but it is a thing I see people doing a lot that kind of bothers me. Like, why aren't you doing it obsessively? Why aren't you constantly putting stuff out?
Yep.
Those are the people who succeed are the people who are just constantly putting stuff out in whatever medium they can think of, you know? Yeah. And a lot, I'm really excited by a lot of these sort of new, I would call them amateur comedians who maybe got into it accidentally, who do a funny TikTok video and suddenly they have a million followers. And then they have an enterprise and they're like, oh, I better start doing social media. I start better building an email list or whatever. You know, some guy does a funny video and suddenly he's like a comedy superstar. Mm-hmm. That's fascinating to me. And I point to all these people who, you know, have always wanted to be in comedy and have really tried hard to do it by following these other paths. I point to that and I say, like, just do a video, like do one every as often as you can, because you never know when one is really going to hit, you know?
No, that's actually a great one. Luke and our other comedian friend, David Studebaker, do a lot of TikTok videos.
Right.
And they love that stuff. And then I do other things, like I said, commercials and stuff. And that stuff's been taking off and working with comedic actors and helping them make videos that works. And so
awesome.
you have to find your path. I always want to write satire, but my satire, I don't know, somehow comes out meaner than it's intended to. Like, it's not supposed to. It's just supposed to be. I like want to take it to the extreme version of whatever the thing is. And then people are like, oh, that's mean. What was the word somebody used? I forgot what it was, but it's like some kind of, it's a person who makes things extra mean, I guess, on the internet. And I forgot what the term was, but
troll.
It's not troll. It's like above trolling. It's like even worse than trolling.
Ooh, worse than troll.
Yeah.
An online bully.
Yeah. But they were like, oh, you're really attacking these people. And I was like, no, I'm just doing like the really like weird version of what they could be. And he's like, yeah, no, that's not good. So I was like, all right, well, I'll let it go.
Interesting.
Well, where can people find you, Scott? Where can people find more about you, your classes, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, I'm mostly at howtowritefunny.com. I got a bunch of free resources there for people who want to learn comedy. There's a How to Write Funny YouTube channel. People can subscribe to that. They get my videos and I put my podcast up there, the How to Write Funny podcast. And so, yeah, all the courses are on the website. You can peruse those. And my books are on Amazon, the How to Write Funny books. And then, you know, all the fiction books that I do, the comedy books are up there as well.
Perfect. Luke, where can everybody find you at?
Luke LaCoy on the socials.
All right. You can go to jamesdcrevison.com or comedypreneur.com and please like and subscribe to Queen Comedy Podcast, the Comedypreneur Show, and my monologue series. I'm trying to write more monologue jokes called You Already Know, where I just write, you know, it's like 1 to 2 minutes of monologue jokes. Some are funny, some are not. Hope you guys enjoy them. Thank you again, Scott, for being here. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, James.
All right. Thank you guys so much. Have a good one. Bye.